It's election week in America. Today, we meet the voters rooting for four more years of Donald Trump. And tomorrow, Anoushka looks at what sort of president Joe Biden would be.
We hear a lot about people who've abandoned Trump, but I was very interested in talking to those who've stuck with him through these 4 years. I mean, very turbulent 4 years, probably the most turbulent presidency in living memory, perhaps aside from the last years of Richard Nixon.
Joe Biden will drive this country into the ground.
4 years!
And we see on the television, we see in the news, you know, the uber Trump supporters, the flag wavers, the gun wavers, the aggressive in your face defenders of Trump. They may be the most visible supporters, but they're certainly not the majority. And I was more interested in the ordinary Trump voter. Why are they sticking with him after 4 years, particularly in areas that may or may not have done particularly well under Trump? What was the continued appeal?
Chris McGreal is a reporter for The Guardian in the US. And for the past few weeks, he's been on the road. Beginning in the South, he drove up through Appalachian coal country, then on to Detroit, Michigan, once an engine of American manufacturing, and then up to the northern reaches of Minnesota on the border with Canada. Many of these places came out for Trump in 2016, and Chris wanted to find out if they would do again. Tomorrow, voters across the US will decide whether Donald Trump gets four more years in the White House or if he'll be a one-term president. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, who are the voters sticking with Trump? Let's start with the places where Trump has a safe vote, like West Virginia. What is it like as a place, and who did you meet there?
So I was in a part of West Virginia, the very southwestern part, which is amongst the poorest part of the state. It's mining country, it's coal country. And at one point, it was extremely prosperous on the back of coal. I went to a town called Williamson, a population of about 3,000 people. And you can see that there was a time when it had money. It's a couple of main streets, used to have department stores and a Chevrolet dealership. That's all long gone as coal faded and the place became poorer. It's been very badly blighted by the opioid epidemic. At one point, it seemed that its major industry in town was a pill mill, a place where doctors were just dispensing opioids to anyone that wanted them. People came from hundreds of miles around and the city became known as Pilliamson as a result. I met Beau Copley and his wife, Lauren, in a diner. He works on the coal mines, essentially in maintenance. He was a maintenance supervisor. We met in these COVID distance times, sitting in a distant table in the window.
I honestly believe that if Donald Trump came out tomorrow and said, I have a plan that will help bring world peace, I think a lot of the headlines the day after would say, Trump vows to end military.
Right.
It doesn't matter what he does. The people who don't like him are going to spin whatever he says and try to play it negatively.
He had lost his job just before, about a year before the last election on the mines. And the mines have been in retreat for years, but there's been a real sense of sudden decline under Obama. And a narrative took hold, pushed by the coal industry in the area, that this was down to Obama's environmental regulations, that he was out to put the coal mines out of business.
Was there any truth to that?
Certainly the environmental regulations made it more hard for some of the coal mines, and particularly some elements of strip mining. But at the same time, it has to be said that coal mining, particularly in that area of West Virginia, has been under pressure from a couple of things. Firstly, West Virginia coal is expensive to mine, for a start. So when the price of coal falls, it's not economic. Plus, the whole industry has been under great pressure from natural gas, which has become a much cheaper way of fueling heat in America.
You know, it's not a renewable source. Eventually, no matter how long it does last, it's going to play out. I want to see somebody who's there who's going to give us a chance to use it and utilize it while we have it and can, until we can develop other things and move forward.
So how did that play into how Beau Copley voted in 2016?
Hillary Clinton turned up in Williamson, and he was invited to a round table with her as the Democratic candidate, as an unemployed mine worker. And a couple of months earlier, Hillary Clinton had made a remark.
I'm the only candidate which has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean, renewable energy as the key into coal country, because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. Right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people.
And Beau Copley, very politely, confronted her with this at their meeting at the round table.
I just want to know how you can say you're going to put a lot of coal miners out of jobs and then come in here and tell us how you're going to be our friend, because those people out there don't see you as a friend.
I know that, Beau. And, you know, I don't know how to explain it other than what I said was totally out of context from what I meant, because I have been talking about helping coal country for a very long time.
We met her on Monday, and Thursday was the National Day of Prayer in Charleston, West Virginia. Donald Trump was there that evening and had a rally, and we got invited to come to that.
America will be great again. We'll be America first. We'll start winning, winning, winning. And you are going to be very proud. And for those miners, get ready, because you're going to be working your asses off, all right? Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
I had a family member say that she was listening to Fox News, and he mentioned the coal miner in West Virginia and said something about my family. It's a beautiful family, you know, those, you know, Donald Trump.
Right. Never having met them.
Yeah, beautiful family.
It didn't then help that a couple of months later, Clinton made her infamous deplorables remark, in which she said that half of all Trump supporters belong in a basket of deplorables because of their attitudes to social issues and to women. So I think Beau Copley walked away from all of that just determined that Trump was probably going to be for the better.
Someone with a different view on how to drive our country, or as far as economy and those kind of things, because people give him a lot of grief. They say that he's a businessman and he's only for businesses. Well, if you don't have businesses, you don't have people who work for those businesses, and you don't have people who earn money to go spend in businesses. So you have to have those for the rest of us to be able to survive.
Do you need a fresh tea?
Please.
Okay, I'll be right back.
He did vote with some reservation, it has to be said. He was, like his wife, very concerned about Trump's manner, the way that he talked about women, his habit of making fun of disadvantaged people.
Not that I consider him a godly person, but at least he was telling me the things that I wanted to hear about conservative Supreme Court justices and those kind of things. Those are the things that are number one to me. Mm-hmm. And then the economy falls in line after that. And I was just looking for someone different. You've had the same players in Washington for decades, and we seem to have the same problems over and over and over.
That's interesting. So it wasn't so much Trump persuading him as a combination of that and his dissatisfaction with the Democrats.
Yes, I think there's a very much a sense, reinforced by the kind of statements that Hillary Clinton made, that historically the Democrats might have been their party, but they didn't represent them anymore. They didn't care about working people, and that they looked down on people in that region. And I'd heard that from others, including a Democratic activist who said to me, you know, the Democrats come across to people around here as the kind of people who want your vote but would never have a beer with you, whereas the Republicans at least buy you a beer before they ask for your vote.
What did Beau tell you about what his life has been like for the last 4 years?
Beau then said that the mines started up when Trump lifted some of the environmental regulation. That eased the pressure. Some of the mines went back to work or expanded. If they hadn't closed, they expanded their hiring.
you definitely saw an uptick. We used to get behind 18-wheelers hauling coal, and you used to find it as the bane to your existence. You didn't like to follow them, and then it got to the point where you didn't follow them at all, and you realized what it was doing to everyone around you. And then you started to see those trucks on the road again.
And after 3 years of being unemployed, a couple of years into Trump's term, then Beau got a job. It's not as well paid as his previous mine job, but it's a job, and he's very grateful for it. And he essentially thanks Trump for that. Until that point, in the 3 years of his unemployment, his family had been relying on his wife Lauren's work as a family portrait photographer. But of course, you know, one income doesn't go a long way in modern America. And so they really struggled along. So that's been transformational for him.
So Beau seems to believe that Trump has certainly in his life and in his community delivered on his promise in 2016 to bring back and protect jobs in this part of America. But is this really the case?
I doubt it is long term. And I mean, certainly his promise to revive the coal industry is very patchy, because you can go to other parts of the country where this simply hasn't happened. But as we know, people, you know, vote their personal experience. So for him and for that part of West Virginia, they feel that he is delivering.
People's attitudes change. People have a glimmer of hope that they can go out and do the things they used to do, travel, shop, do, you know, the things that most people do or used to do, and then for a while seemed like they couldn't. So
Chris, Donald Trump didn't get into the White House just because of voters like Beau. He also managed to convert Democrat voters to support the Republican Party, didn't he?
He certainly did. And one of the reasons he was able to do that was, though, for some of the same reasons that Beau Copley voted for him, which was he persuaded a lot of Americans that he was listening to them. There was a perception, not unreasonably, that previous presidents, both Democrat and Republican, were no longer acting in the interests of the American worker, that they were acting in the interests of big capital, of corporations, which wield enormous influence in Washington because of the power of their money. There was a real feeling, particularly in states like Michigan, big industrial states, you know, Detroit was the engine of American industrialization and the growth of its middle class, the big car companies. Those kind of places looked at Trump and thought, essentially, well, let's give him a try. A lot of Democrats felt they had nothing to lose after 8 years of Obama, who, from their perspective, really hadn't changed anything very much. And they were very persuaded by that.
So on your trip, who did you meet that fits into this group?
So I went to northern Minnesota, a part of the state that's known as the Iron Range, because it has big iron ore mines, and their business depends on demand for steel. And up there, I met a woman called Andrea Supancic.
I mean, I have very good friends that are Democrats, the old Democrats, and I believe exactly what they believe.
Right.
But their party doesn't necessarily go that way anymore, and I think they don't understand that.
Who is a mayor of a small town there, part-time mayor, non-partisan, they're elected without a political label. But also an estate agent. She owns her own estate agency. And she had been a long-time Democratic voter, twice voting for Barack Obama, but was persuaded by Trump on pretty much the single issue of the issue of China dumping steel on the United States. This has been a long-standing grievance which parts of the country spent many years trying to get Obama to address, which is essentially steel dumping is very cheap steel made in China, gets sold in the United States and severely undermines the local industry. And if the steel mills of Michigan aren't working and Ohio aren't working, then there's no demand for the iron ore that comes from northern Minnesota.
I just think the party has gone far away from my beliefs.
And Andrea essentially thought, well, she pleaded with the Obama administration repeatedly, as had other politicians in the area, for some action, and nothing had happened. So she decided to vote for Trump and just take a chance because he said he was going to confront China. And that was her primary issue.
We had a pool table company over there, and they were doing great. And then somehow China was able to replicate their pool tables and sell them for less than it cost them to even make it. So they went out of business. And then our town lost maybe 20 jobs, 20 or 30 jobs. Now, that's not a big number. That's like maybe a school class size. But for our town, it's a big number. You know, if you put it in a percentage, we're only about 1,500 people. So,
and put it in that percentage, how does she feel about him numbers. 4 years on? Does she still support him? I mean, she's, you know, it's quite hard for me to imagine what could make someone vote for Obama and then switch to Trump a few years later.
Andrea's more strongly for Trump than ever.
I don't necessarily agree with everything that Trump has done, but I agree with the majority of what he has done. Just like any other person, I don't always agree with my best friend, but, you know, it's still my friend.
On the steel, she says that Trump's trade war with China, his restrictions on them dumping steel, has revived demand for iron ore in the region. But there are other issues for Andrea too, and that strike quite close to home, actually. When the riots broke out and the protests after the police killing of George Floyd in May, that was in Minneapolis, which is a major city in Minnesota. And Andrea's daughter's in the National Guard, and she was called up to go and police those.
And, you know, when your child is in the military, you kind of get used to the idea of, like, all right, they're going to go save us from foreign entities and go fight for us and blah, blah, blah. I had a hard time wrapping my head around that she was going to protect Americans from Americans.
To Andrea's horror, she saw the Democrats as being on the side of the rioters and protesters when Trump was condemning them. And so she's very much shifted her perception of who the Democrats are. A little bit like the West Virginians. And she now sees them not only as weak on issues like trade and elitist, but she sees them as siding with the wrong people from her perspective.
I mean, I'm very sad for what had happened in Minneapolis. There's no doubt about it. But
she's not unsympathetic to the Black Lives Matter cause. And you hear this a lot. Yes, I agree with their aims, but I don't like the way things are going. I don't like how they're going about it. And she feels very strongly on that. So that has pushed her even further into the Trump camp.
I mean, Minneapolis is a Democratic run city. And then they're blaming the Republicans? I don't understand that. I don't.
And she's not alone in that. She was amongst six formerly Democratic mayors in northern Minnesota who in August signed a joint letter supporting Trump and denouncing Biden, saying that the Democrats and Biden no longer represented the working class in that part of the country.
It wasn't just Andrea you were speaking to. You met many others who used to vote for the Democratic Party, switched to Trump in 2016, and are now going back to him again. Why do you think this is?
I think for a lot of them, it's the move away from the Democratic Party came before Trump came along. They were already retreating. For whatever reason it may be, they were losing confidence in the Democratic Party, perhaps reinforced by a couple of things. One is there was so much hope invested in Obama. And the reality was that people really didn't see that much change. Now, you can pin plenty of that on deliberately obstructionist Republicans in Congress led by Mitch McConnell in the Senate. But it doesn't alter the fact that people felt that Obama really hadn't delivered what he'd promised. And I think one of the people I saw this most dramatically with is a woman called Lisa Matthews, who lives in North Carolina.
So my mom was a single mom at the age of 23 with two kids. Oh, and wow. She had a GED. She didn't have like a college education or anything like that. So we lived on food stamps and that kind of stuff.
Lisa's African American and from a very poor town in New Jersey called Camden.
And I had two of my cousins were killed there in the city, and my stepbrother was murdered as well. My uncle was killed by an unknown shooter in 1987. So I had a lot of tragedy as well in the family.
She became, in the end, determined to get out.
I had actually had a college scholarship when I graduated from high school because we were very, very studious. We wanted to get out of there, just not live in that type of environment. And we were able to do that. And that is why I believe that the American dream is a reality for anyone who wants it. It's just
Lisa began to look back and say to herself, well, why was I in that situation? And one of the things she concluded was that the Democrats had kept her there, that the Democrats who, she said, claimed to speak for poor people and minorities, African-American communities, actually, she said, they just push a message of reliance on welfare and that you're oppressed. She voted for Obama in 2008 in that first election, and she concluded that he was just pushing the same message.
I grew up in the inner city, okay? And I know that there's people there who need to see somebody like him do well. And I felt like even though he wasn't technically the black president, he really was, because the black community rallied around him. They voted overwhelmingly for him. And I felt like he could have came back and said, this is how me and Michelle got out of the south side of Chicago. This is what we did so we can help people, lift people up, instead of telling people, you're oppressed, you need help, let me give you a handout. You went to Harvard. You, your wife went to Harvard. Why can't you tell black people how you guys did it?
So in 2012, she didn't vote. She moved away from the Democrats, but she couldn't bring herself to vote for a Republican. She didn't want to vote against Obama because, as she said, she was still genuinely excited that America had its first black president. But by 2016, she was in a different place. She had started to identify as a Republican. In the primary, she voted for Ted Cruz, which is a very interesting choice because Ted Cruz is a Texas senator who is seen as very much on the fringes of the Republican Party. But as she watched Trump campaign, once he was the candidate, she started to buy into his presidency.
I always watched this TV show. I loved it. My daughter, when she was a little kid, she would always say, you're fired. Like, we would have this little joke. And I just thought he was just, you know, great American, New Yorker, businessman. He was just the epitome of what America is, like, loud, brash, throwing money around. You know, you see him in Vegas, stuff like that. It's like if Don King ran for office. You just know the guy. But no, I never had any issues with him. So I was surprised when people started having issues with him, like Donald Trump. Like, I never heard anything bad about him before he ran for office. We all liked him. Everybody did.
And how does she feel about him now?
She loves him even more. She feels that he has delivered on everything he promised to the extent that he's been able to. And if he hasn't been able to, it's because the Democrats and others have got in his way.
Liberian community. There was 4,000 Liberians who had no legal status in this country. Boom. They all got a path to citizenship with a strike of a pen, just like that. There's a Hispanic prosperity initiative that helps, that's helping kids have school choice. Of course, the constitutional judges that he's getting in place all around the country and in the Supreme Court. And I feel like he's bringing people together. I don't know what other people say with it, but I feel like, because I just meet people everywhere I go. I had this Trump sticker on my car the other day. I'm driving down the street, and this car just like rode up on me really fast and then came alongside of me, and I was like, what is he doing? And they just started waving and smiling and giving me a thumbs up, and I was like, oh, hi. Like, I just meet people where they're all happy, friendly, nice, lovely people who just have families, jobs, and they just want to live the American dream.
So in Lisa and Andrea, then, you have two voters there who have become even more loyal to Trump over the last 4 years. Why do you think that is?
They feel quite defensive for him in some ways. Also, they feel defensive for themselves. A lot of Trump supporters have taken a lot of stick for voting for him in the first place, but certainly those who have stuck with him have been condemned quite widely in this country as idiots, as racists, as voting against their own interests. And I think those that have decided to stick with him, particularly if they're doing it publicly, have doubled down on him.
After this, why Trump's base isn't enough to guarantee him a second term. Chris, you've met many Trump voters who have reinforced their support for him over the past 4 years. But is this enough for him to win?
No, it's not. He's in deep trouble, particularly in the areas that we've been talking about. I travel around the Midwest. The rarest voter that I meet is somebody that voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and is now so happy with what's happened over the past 4 years that they're voting for Trump. You hardly ever meet those. And that's a big problem for Trump, because one of the reasons he won 4 years ago was so many people stayed home. People that didn't like Clinton but weren't going to vote for Trump. And you saw it in the big cities, in particular in the swing states, the enormous drop-off. So if you look at Detroit, the the turnout amongst Democratic voters there dropped off by 60,000 votes in a state Trump won only by 10,704 votes. So those people, a lot of them are going to turn out this year. And so Trump's challenge is to find new voters, new supporters to offset that. And I think he's struggling to hang on to the people he's already got. He's got those core voters we've been talking about, but he's losing people around the edges. And I think that's his real problem.
So who were the people who voted for him in 2016 who were abandoning him now and putting on the pressure for him to find new voters?
It's a bit of a coalition. It's a mix of blue-collar workers in industrial areas. But there was one other group which was very significant because I think it shocked a lot of people, is that Trump won more votes from white women than Hillary Clinton did, which I think a lot of people were surprised by given his misogyny and the comments he made. Those voters are undoubtedly retreating. If we look at the opinion polls now, he has a deficit amongst white women, and a lot of them will be white suburban women.
Suburban women, will you please like me? Remember? Please. I saved your damn neighborhood, okay?
They're in the category of just being horrified by his demeanor, by his behavior in general, but also particularly coronavirus. I think they take coronavirus seriously and they feel he hasn't.
And this is at a time when he's discouraging people from postal voting. And also there's a pandemic. He needs people to go out and go to the ballot box. How is he persuading them to do that?
He's got himself into a bit of a bind here because he wanted to set up a means of challenging the election result, which is to try and discredit the postal voting. The problem with that is it's discouraged his own supporters from voting by post. So that means they're either having to turn out, if you can, depending on the state, and do early voting, and it's very high in lots of areas, or they're going to have to turn out on election day, which is going to be in long lines. Now, they may or may not care about coronavirus, but there's always that risk. So to some degree, he's undermined his own voters. But I think the determined Trump voters will turn out no matter what. They like their man, they'll be there. We're back to how does he get those wavering Trump voters, the people who voted for him 4 years ago. I think the danger for him here is that, not that they'll turn out and vote for Biden, but they just won't turn out. They won't bother. They'll say to themselves, I can't bring myself to vote for Trump again, or it's just too much effort, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, particularly if they're older voters, they want to take the risk. And that's a danger for him because he needs every vote if you see a surge in the cities in voting, because that surge almost certainly heavily favours the Democrats.
When it comes down to it, is this election a referendum on Trump rather than a case for Biden, do you think?
Yes, I think it's absolutely a referendum on Trump, and it's if within that is a referendum on coronavirus, although that isn't the only issue. Certainly his handling of coronavirus has damaged him quite enormously. His one big asset in the past has been the state of the economy. He could claim an economic boom, largely based on the stock market, actually, rather than people's standards of living. But nonetheless, that was the perception. That's all gone out the window with coronavirus. Problem is that he won a lot of these states by tiny, tiny margins. And he doesn't even need to lose all of them. He just needs to lose two or three. And then he's probably, that will cost him the White House. And if he loses Florida, he's completely done for. So I think he's got a big challenge on his hands. But as we know, the way American elections go, don't discount very last minute surprises. And if there's a president that can pull out surprises, it's Trump.
Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Chris McGreal. Read his brilliant coverage of the election, and in particular, the impact COVID has had on it, at theguardian.com. Also, if you want to learn more about the opioid epidemic in Williamson that Chris mentioned, we made a podcast with him last year about this, called How Did a Town in West Virginia Become the Opioid Capital of the US? It was based on Chris's book, American Overdose, which is available to buy now. We are going to be bringing you coverage of the US election throughout this week. Tomorrow, Anushka will be focusing on Joe Biden, looking at what drives him and what kind of president he would be. That's all for today. Thank you to Chris, Beau, Lauren, Andrea and Lisa. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.